way back when, Christians decided to come in out of the cold, and they were then faced with the problem of how do you keep water, rain, sleet, snow, and ice out, and how do you bring water and heat in and not destroy the place? And as we learned this winter, that is not an easy task. There are practical problems of how you create space for the family of faith, and there are also theological problems. And Christians have been discussing and debating and talking and praying and thinking about this for a long time. And that's why we were so pleased several years ago when Ralph and Roberta Cook determined to establish this lectureship in memory of Ralph's father, Elmer. Ralph and Roberta are here. I would like them to stand so that you can greet them. It is good to have you with us, and for you as well as us to celebrate the reality of this dream, namely the possibility of coming together on a regular basis, at least once a year, to talk about architecture from the standpoint of the faith community. It's now my pleasure to introduce John Payne, our professor of church history, who will introduce the speakers. John.
I am pleased to introduce the program for this occasion of the celebration of the 100th anniversary of the building of this beautiful structure. The seminary trustees laid the plans for the building in 1892 and made the final decision concerning its design and erection in late January 1893. They awarded the contract on May 19, 1893 to John Evans, who submitted the lowest bid of $29,340, not including, however, the heating or the brownstone used in connection with the brickwork. The Hummelstown Brownstone Company furnished the brownstone at a price of $9,545. The contract required the completion of the building by May 1st, 1894. As it turned out, they were 9 days late. Terrible. Tonight, we are privileged to have two speakers to comment on the significance of this edifice, now known as the Lark Building. Mr. Robert Yeager will discuss the architectural roots of the building in his lecture entitled A Sacred Trust, the Public Role of Religious Buildings. The Reverend Rochelle Stackhouse will treat the liturgical aspects of the design of this chapel, known as Santee Chapel, though previously it was known as Santee Prayer Hall. The chapel was extensively remodeled and received its present design in 1925 on the 100th anniversary of the founding of the seminary in another place called Carlisle. Ms. Stackhouse's discussion will no doubt deal with a bit of seminary history which preceded the erection of this building by 50 years, namely the Mercersburg theology, which emerged when the seminary was located at Mercersburg, Pennsylvania, from 1837 to 1871, for this theology affected the design of this chapel. And though I am tempted to comment on that, I am resisting and not wanting to steal any of Shelley's thunder. Mr. Yeager was educated at the University of Michigan, where he took his MBA degree, and at Cornell University, where he received his master's degree in historic preservation planning. After working for several years with IBM Corporation, Mr. Yeager moved into the field of historic preservation. He took a position with Philadelphia Historic Preservation Corporation in 1984 and eventually was named as this organization's Senior Vice President for Religious Properties Programs. Since 1989, he has been co-director of Partners for Sacred Places, an organization he helped to found. Its purpose is to promote the preservation and sound stewardship of religious properties. He has also been editor of Inspired, a national bi-monthly magazine. Ms. Dackhouse is a graduate of Millersville University with a BA degree and a Princeton Theological Seminary with a BD degree, and she is currently a PhD candidate in liturgical studies at Drew University. She has been a pastor of United Church of Christ congregations in Michigan and New York. Since 1991, she has served as adjunct professor of worship here at Lancaster Theological Seminary. In 1992 to 93, she did double duty, also as dean of the chapel. She has just received a call to a UCC church of the congregational variety just south of Boston. And we shall miss her when she leaves us. We are pleased to have you both as our speakers for this Cook Lectureship on the 100th anniversary of this building. The format will be for each of the speakers to make a presentation in turn and then for them to engage in a little dialogue with one another, and then finally for us all to have an opportunity to join in with comments or questions. I think Ms. Dackhouse will lead off.
Thank you, John. As John told you, I went to seminary at Princeton, although I am a member of the United Church of Christ. And the chapel at Princeton Seminary on the outside looks like a Greek temple, and on the inside looks like a congregational church. Both of the churches that I have served as pastor come from the congregational Christian side of the UCC. And the sanctuaries of those churches both were very plain on the inside, very light, very bright, with windows that did not have pictures in them, with no symbols or no fancy carvings or anything that might be seen to be Catholic by the congregationalists who inhabited the spaces. Light and simplicity was the key to the design. Imagine my shock then upon entering Santee Chapel for the first time. The congregationalist piece of me gasped, "This is a chapel in a UCC seminary?" It looked like a Lutheran or maybe an Episcopal church to me. Dark wood, pictures of people. You can't see it because it's dark now, but there are people in those stained glass windows. Icons, pelicans in the stone, for goodness sake. I hated it. Then in God's good humor, I was invited to spend a year as dean of this chapel. And that gave me an excuse to spend some time here, both in worship and in meditation, and a chance to explore the nooks and crannies of this place and get to understand what it's about and how it's used. I began to see the extraordinary tapestry of this place and how it both reflects the history and pushes the future of the community that meets here for worship and that meets here to learn about worship. And so in my piece of the lecture tonight, I want to do a bit of taking apart of the warp and weft of that tapestry in terms of Santee Chapel's liturgical significance to the church, and leave Robert to walk you through the architectural wonders of the space. Now, in order to do that, and because all of us gathered here come from a variety of backgrounds, I need to walk through a little bit of the history of the wider church and of the specific church tradition which created and used this chapel, and a little bit of the history of the space itself beyond what John already told you. And then I'm going to look at some of the specific parts of this chapel and how they fit in to that history and how they are significant for our future in this space. And so I ask your indulgence for a little bit of church history, and I ask John's indulgence. The standard schoolbook story of the Reformation goes something like this. In the 16th century, the medieval Roman Catholic Church abused the faith of the people by promoting superstition and making worship so fancy that the people were no longer part of it. This story then describes how the reformers, usually pictured by Martin Luther banging on the door of the church at Wittenberg, came in and swept the church clean of superstition, took down the statues, taught the people to sing in German instead of stuffy Latin. Well, of course, none of the story was ever quite that simple, nor was the Reformation a homogeneous phenomenon across Europe. Certainly, there had been abuses in the medieval church, and there have been abuses at every stage of church history. And reform was called for. But the reform that happened was not simply a clean out the church and start all over again kind of thing. The aim of the major and the more radical reformers was to return to the life and worship of the early church. John Calvin's liturgies for the churches in Strasbourg and Geneva had this title, "The Form of Church Prayers and Hymns According to the Custom of the Ancient Church." The reformers wanted to get back to what they saw as the purer form of the original Christian worship. The problem was that the information available in the 16th century about the original worship of the church was very, very sketchy, to say the least. In the centuries since Calvin, scholars have discovered that the early churches had a rich and quite varied worship life, depending on the location and ethnic makeup of the church in question. For there was not really anything that we can call the early church. There were early churches. Much of this information on early worship life was unavailable to the 16th century reformers. But it began to surface in a big way in the middle of the 19th century. And that, among other things, gave birth to something we now call the liturgical movement. It began in the monasteries of continental Europe with a new look at music, specifically what we call Gregorian chant, and with an attention to the sacrament of Holy Communion. It spread to England and eventually resulted in what we now call the Oxford movement or the Anglo-Catholic movement. And it spread to this country, and it manifests itself in Pennsylvania in the Mercersburg movement. Scholars and worship planners and leaders across the Western world responded differently to the new information coming to us about the ancient and early medieval churches. But several common threads run through all the varied movements, which I think relate to this space in which we sit today. And I want to run through some of those threads with you. First is a renewed attention to how art and architecture function in the life of a worshiping community, especially giving attention to the practices of the Eastern churches, where more of the earliest church art forms were preserved. A revival of interest in Gothic and Romanesque architecture followed. Second, a new attention to the forms of celebrating the sacraments, and especially Holy Communion. This attention focused on both the words and the actions of the rite. Third, a renewed interest in the church year and its various festivals, and therefore in the use of a lectionary to determine which scripture would be read each Sunday. And fourth, a renewed interest in music beyond hymns and psalms, both musical form and the words of church music. Now, running throughout all of these themes was a strong sense that while modern worship need not duplicate past forms, those past forms can and should inform modern worship. Again, to use the tapestry image, the worship of the past is the warp on which one weaves the pattern for the present. That's a really quick sketch about the liturgical movement, but I hope you get the general picture of the atmosphere. Two people deeply embedded in the early years of the liturgical movement were John Nevin, an American, originally a Presbyterian, and Philip Schaff from the University of Berlin and the Evangelical Church of the Prussian Union, which was both Lutheran and Reformed. Nevin and Schaff taught at the theological school at Mercersburg, Pennsylvania, which eventually moved to the F&M campus in 1871, and then across the street to this site 100 years ago. Both men were scholars of church history and theology, and they saw what they felt was a bankruptcy in the worship life of the American church in the middle of the 19th century. Remember what was going on at this point in American churches. This was the latter half of the Second Great Awakening. It was a time of large revival movements and tent meetings. Worship in the revival churches often had little structure, little connection to anything that had been done in worship in the past, and lots of emotion. John Nevin criticized this shallow worship and criticized as well the clergy-dominated, downright boring worship in many Reformed churches, where the entire service was essentially read by the minister with no congregational participation. Nevin and Schaff understood the center of theology and ecclesiology to be the doctrine of the Incarnation. They understood Christ to be incarnate today in the church, the body of Christ. They saw this in an organic way and in a mystical way. And they defined church as going beyond any one congregation or tradition or time period. They understood there to be an organic unity between the churches of all times and places, tested and corrected by the scriptures. And they felt that the worship life of the church should reflect both the mystical incarnation and that organic unity. So they set about working on a reform to the liturgy of the German Reformed churches in this country. Now, any of you who have ever tried to change what happens in worship in a local church know how hard that is. Liturgy in any given congregation often has less to do with sound theology and a connection to the church universal than with local tradition and preference. Now, many of us say that the 11th commandment for churches is we've always done it this way. And keep in mind that always is a relative term. Well, Nevin and Schaff, in seeking to break beyond that, did some corresponding with people in Europe involved in the broader liturgical movement. They, in particular, contacted a group in England called the Catholic Apostolic Church, or the Irvingites, named after their leader. This small group had attempted in worship to blend the traditions of early churches, the traditions of Eastern Orthodoxy, with the sensibilities of the Reformation. Now, that's quite a challenge. And they did it somewhat successfully, and Schaff especially was impressed with what they had done and borrowed heavily from them in his pieces of the liturgy. Well, the liturgy that Nevin and Schaff and their committee eventually created reflects many of these concerns that we've talked about of the liturgical movement. Their worship book gives prominence to the church year and to lectionary. Though they were overruled by the synod, they wanted to make the service of the Lord's Supper the normative Sunday service. The intention was that the sacrament be celebrated weekly, as opposed to the usual quarterly or less practice at the time. Every service in the book includes participatory sections, including sung responses from the worship of the ancient church, things like the Gloria in Excelsis. Jack Maxwell describes the result of this liturgy this way. Armed with scripture, a sizable array of historic liturgies, and a sensitive poetic spirit, Philip Schaff composed his work, borrowing, adapting, and freely creating fresh forms which would articulate Reformed theology, yet which would also forge a devotional bond between a small band of 19th century German immigrants in an American commonwealth and the saints of all the ages. Once again, I've romped you very quickly through Mercersburg, and you can talk with John Payne at some point and get a lot bigger picture of what Mercersburg is like, fill in the potholes that I have left in this. But I want to move on to this space and how it reflects both Mercersburg and the larger liturgical movement of which it was part. The Mercersburg liturgy in its various revisions was not universally accepted nor used in Nevin and Schaff's lifetime, but it had a profound, long-lasting effect on worship in the Reformed churches. We know that when Mercersburg Seminary moved to Lancaster, the Mercersburg liturgy, or the order of worship, was used for regular worship at the Franklin and Marshall Chapel. At the seminary's semi-centennial celebration in 1875, a professor named Dr. Apple gave an address in which he noted that the seminary had rehabilitated the church festivals and the order of the church year in such a way as to give them real spiritual power in the church. So clearly, the spirit of Mercersburg was thriving in the seminary. 50 years later, the Mercersburg liturgy was still in use in local churches, and a prayer and lecture hall was enlarged and refurbished to become Santee Chapel. The workshops of the Oberammergau Passion Players were commissioned to do this woodwork that you're looking at. A stained glass studio in Boston was commissioned to provide windows depicting both biblical figures and major figures from the history of Christianity. Masons created a high altar, a pulpit, and a lectern from sandstone. A new pipe organ was installed for the musical life of the community. What had been the Santee Prayer Hall, which sounds like something out of those revivals that Nevin hated so much, became a chapel whose purpose as a place of worship was clear. So what do these renovations tell us about the liturgical theology of the time? Well, the liturgical movement is written all over this room. Consider the emphasis on sacramental theology. This thing up here is decidedly an altar, not a table. Overcoming the Zwinglian theology, which emphasized much more the gathering around the table in memory, the altar lifts up the higher sense of the sacrament and the sacrificial pieces of the sacrament of Holy Communion. Word and sacrament, the pulpit and the altar made out of the same material, are united as one, although the sacrament receives the higher place because it is in the center and not the pulpit. Consider the windows, and I wish you could see them. If you have not been here before, come back in the daytime and take a look at them. They are definitely not in the Tiffany style of realism. They are much more reminiscent of medieval and of early medieval church windows. The pictures make firm the organic unity of the church throughout the ages that Schaff spoke about. From the Old Testament, we move to Jesus, to the apostles, and then in one window are the figures of Augustine and Francis of Assisi in a Protestant seminary. Augustine, the great theologian of the ancient church, and Francis, the model for service of the medieval church. Both of them also crucial to the development of worship. Also representing the medieval church is Jan Hus, the first martyr for reform. The great reformers are then represented by Zwingli and Calvin, and very interestingly, in a German reform seminary, a picture of John Knox, again perhaps broadening to the wider tradition. Now, each of those folk only gets one pane, but that window over there has Martin Luther, and it has Martin Luther three times. Very prominent and highly unusual in a non-Lutheran church. Organic unity beyond tradition. There's a window that highlights the Heidelberg Catechism, which is intended to draw the German Reformed folk away from the revivalism of the American frontier and back to the solid theology of their German roots. And finally, the windows come around back to Jesus, whose presence in this chapel is represented both in many pictures and also in the sacramental nature of the high altar. You can't miss it. And if you talk to Peter Schmeichen about the windows, he will tell you that that window over there, which has the apostles in it, has John at the top in the most prominent place. Because, Peter says, John was Nevin's favorite gospel, the mystical gospel. Behind the altar are six icons in a Protestant chapel. These were added in 1959. They were the gift of a former professor in memory of his wife and copied from icons in the Cathedral of Palermo, Sicily. Although I don't know for sure the rationale behind the choice of this memorial, they fit in beautifully with the sense of the liturgical movement in this chapel. They lift up an art form of the Eastern churches, which reflects the mystical incarnational theology of Mercersburg. And the organ, in its prominent position, reflects a concern for quality and importance of music in worship, and it is built to play the great European musical works more than the gospel hymns of the American Revival. And finally, the design of the space itself, with its large choir and chancel area, with the arches at the back, decidedly reminiscent of monastic architecture and the Romanesque style. But I'm going to leave that to Robert. And I want to close my portion of this lecture with a comment and a quote. The comment concerns the fact that though I have lifted up how this space connects worshipers with the wider traditions of the church in the past, this space is not meant to be, nor was it ever meant to be, a museum. The concept of the communion of saints fills this space. And it is important that the space continue to reflect the movement of that communion. It has not been substantially changed since 1925, yet the church and the world have grown and changed. The seminary needs to ask itself how this space might now reflect the organic unity not only with the ancient and medieval European church, but with the church of this century in America, Asia, Africa, Latin America, and elsewhere. And not only with dead men pictured in the windows, but with the saints alive and dead who are women and men and children. Those connections happen here regularly in the words and people of worship. So the question I raise is, how might this space continue to reflect the theology that formed it and make solid those continuing connections? Finally, the quote from Philip Schaff, who else, who urges us in this direction of looking toward the future. And as you listen to it, look around the chapel and see if you can catch his vision of worship. He says that worship is this: a sacred bond of union between the different ages of Christ's church, as a guarantee against excesses of arbitrary freedom, as the organ for the exercise of the general priesthood, and as the artistic form which the very spirit of social worship instinctively assumes. In one word, a truly scriptural, historical, evangelical, Catholic, and artistic liturgy for the people as well as the ministry. Thank you.